Today is Monday, January 30th, 2023. This is part three of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Frank Barrios. And Frank spells his last name B-A-R-R-I-O-S. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Frank. How are you today?
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. Frank, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. I wanted to start off by thanking you so much for the wonderful journey yesterday discussing broad regional issues about water in the West. And this morning I wanted to step back to 1966, and you had graduated from Arizona State University there in Phoenix with a degree in civil engineering and had seen a job opening with the Bureau of Reclamation. Can you pick that thread up for 1966?
Absolutely. I went, they had an office here in Phoenix where they were doing the planning for the Central Arizona Project. This was before it was authorized, but they were doing planning. The Bureau of Reclamation was planning, looking at alignments, looking at whether that we had a drilling crew, we had a survey crew, we had planners, we had hydrologists, we had I don't know the number in the office, but it was a fairly large office with a lot of outside field crews that were working on looking at options for the Central Arizona Project.
Okay.
And I went to work for them in 1966, and the first thing they did is they put me on a training program for about a year. And in that training program, I spent several months with the survey crew. I spent several months with the engineering staff. They had a design engineering crew. I spent time with them. I spent some time with the planning office, who did a lot of the overall planning, and with the hydrology group. And then when I was done, they said, "Well, which one of these areas do you want to go into?" And I picked hydrology.
Okay.
And I worked with them for almost 10 years.
Why did you choose hydrology instead of maybe engineering or planning? What was it about that attracted you?
I don't really know, other than it was it's the way we looked at water. Attracted me. And again, know a little bit about my background in that I picked civil engineering because it was the most general. I still had not said, absolutely, this is what I want to be.
Okay.
But I got into civil engineering, and I got into something that I knew the Central Arizona Project, as I mentioned before, was the biggest project ever, historical significance to Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
It was a do-or-die thing for Arizona, and so I came into work into an area that I felt was extremely important, but I still had not earmarked what I wanted to do. And of all the options that were out there, hydrology seemed to be the one that appealed to me more than the others.
Okay. Where were you living at the time?
I was living at home with my parents.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
No, it was here at 1330 East Osborne Road in Phoenix.
Okay. How far was your commute to work?
Oh, it was probably a couple miles.
Okay.
And in 66, the problems we face today as a city weren't then, and it was an easy commute.
In the station wagon? In the Ford station wagon?
I think I still had it back then, yes.
Okay.
And the office was, the Bureau of Reclamation office was south of Roosevelt. About around 3rd Street, somewhere in there. I don't know the, I don't have the exact address, but they had a building with several offices at that time there.
Okay.
And they, by the way, they were soon to move to a new office. So I didn't stay there very long. And then we moved to another office around, let's see, that would be 2nd Avenue, 3rd Avenue, and Monroe.
Okay. And you had mentioned, sorry, go ahead.
No, but again, and just to, I guess, a continuation of this, I went to work for hydrology and started looking at putting, what basically we did was help in the design of flood control structures that would protect the CAP. We looked at doing flood studies for dams also. When you design the dam, you would design them for 100-year reoccurrence, and then occurrences that are more rare than that. At all costs, the highest was the protection of the structure.
Right.
Because the dam, in many cases, the dam would fail, people would die. And so they had a huge flood that would come, and we designed that flood, and then we designed the spillways in the dam to allow that flood to pass through without damaging the dam.
Okay. One of the things I'm thinking about here is the canal would be crossways, or say 90 degrees to a desert wash, which is dry most of the year, or some years year after year. But then there would be a large storm. It could be a winter storm or a monsoon summer storm, which would put a lot of water suddenly in that dry wash that would head straight for the canal. How did you guys work out a way to bypass that occasional water from a permanent water in a canal?
Well, it depended on the drainage area behind the wash.
Okay.
If you had a major crossing, like the Agua Fria, the Agua Fria crosses, there's a dam upstream from there, which is Waddell Dam, there would be the larger washes with big drainage areas behind them. We would do a pipeline that would go underneath the wash and out the other side. So we wouldn't try to inhibit the water. We would go underneath it.
Okay.
And try to protect it against sometimes the flood waters could scour down and take the pipe out, but we would go deep underneath and come out on the other side.
So for the transcribers, I'm just going to say that's AGUAFRIA for the Agua Fria?
Right, that's just an example.
Just as an example.
We crossed the Salt River also.
Okay.
We crossed it with, I think at the time, it was the largest pipeline in the world was carrying the CAP.
Okay.
And it went under the Salt River and up the other side.
So what you would do is drill a shaft, sink a shaft down, and then a tunnel or a drift over, and then shaft back up to daylight, and so the canal would drop down. The water in the canal would go down that shaft and across that drift and then up the other shaft, and then off again, and above the cross cut would be a river or a dry wash or something like that.
That's correct.
Wow. Okay.
Now, if it was a small drainage area,
yeah,
and because there's little washes that cross all through the CAP, in those cases we would build a dike.
Okay.
And we would, the storm water would come, and these dikes are like little earthen dams.
Okay.
And they would store the water behind them, and then release the water back into the wash at a much lower rate. And so if the you would store the water behind it, and a flood came in, it would store up in the dam, earthen dam, and then there'd be an outlet into the wash that would release the water at a much lower rate, non-damaging rate, past the canal, and it would go on its way to its ultimate end.
So would that be, I'm trying to imagine this, there would be a dike, basically a dam, and it would probably be fairly long because these washes were kind of wide. And then there would be a almost like an inlet that would go down and underneath the canal and come up the other side?
That's correct.
So the...
Or over the top of the canal, too. Could be.
Oh, over the top. Huh. Okay.
Yeah, you could have it would be like the outlets you see in the highways, except that for the canal, the outlet might go over the top of the canal and the water would
go through...
And there'd be an outlet and it would let the water back into the wash that was there.
That makes sense because the canal would be basically at grade, at grade of the local terrain. And so if you had a dike and built that up, it would be easy then to have a water intake structure up in the air, in the dike, that would then go across the canal and then drop down into the wash again.
That's correct. But this is all part of the... And of course, I think you're talking from Parker, Lake Havasu,
right,
clear down to Tucson. You're going to cross a lot of areas,
and
the idea is to protect the canal.
Yes.
And so most of the areas where the canal was were protected by these earthen dikes.
Okay.
Other areas, you would actually, there were places, there were pumping plants that were built. Where they had to, because you had to raise, the canal would operate on gravity until it reached the point and all of a sudden you got to raise the water several hundred feet or something. Then you would build a pumping plant, and the pumping plant would pump the water to the next stage of the canal,
okay,
which is, and it would put the water up, and then it would continue downstream at gravity until it reached another height that it had to reach, and there'd be another pumping plant there.
That makes sense. And those pumps must have been kind of special, I would think, because it's not like you have a dam with a reservoir and a lot of water, you just drop a hose in and just pump that water, because here you have to match the water coming along in the canal, be able to really adequately and correctly measure that to then pump that water up and drop it in a higher canal. So it was real-time pumping, and you couldn't pump too much because then the water would drop and you'd probably cavitate your pumps with air. That sounds like a pretty interesting challenge to balance that.
Well, the headquarters to all of this was on the CAP headquarters on 7th Street, north of Deer Valley Road,
okay,
or north or south of Deer Valley. I think it's north. But they have their main office there. And if you go in there, they have a board, huge board, that shows the entire Central Arizona Project Canal.
Okay.
And they control all of what you just said there at that office. They have a guy, it's all computerized. And it's very impressive. It's the Central Arizona Project headquarters where all of this is controlled, and they have work crews that are out there. If there's a problem, they'll call a crew to go out and see what's happening.
Okay.
They have people located at the pumping plants, but the decisions, most of the decisions on when to pump, when not to pump, all of that is made out of the office of the Central Arizona Project office.
All right. And then,
and the other thing that is done there is they make all these decisions, but you also know the timing of the pumping is important because you're trying to save taxpayers money.
Okay.
When the reason why you built Roosevelt and upgraded Roosevelt, which we'll talk about later, and Waddell was to store water, CAP water.
Okay.
Well, why are you storing it? Because the biggest use of CAP water is during the summer.
Okay.
That's when we use the most water. But if you're pumping during the summer, it's going to cost you more money because the cost of electricity, there's more competition for that water.
Okay.
Everybody wants water during the summer. So what they did is they would pump during the winter.
Okay.
When the cost is less, and it would cost us less money to pump the water from the Colorado River. And we would store that water at Waddell and sometimes through exchanges at Roosevelt.
Okay.
And it would cost us less money. Then during the winter, when the Northwest, Washington, the state of Washington and Oregon, are using more power because of the cold, we sell them water and make a profit on that water we're selling to them. And we actually make, well, I don't think we make money, but we come out with a much better situation because we pump water during when the need is less, and we sell some of our power when the need is
Got it. Okay, for clarification, the CAP would sell electricity to the Pacific Northwest when the CAP had a surplus of electricity.
That's correct, but know that it's what makes it complicated. The Navajo Power Plant is where we get our power, and it's a consortium of a bunch of people, Saw River Project, California, Edison, and the CAP.
Okay.
All of them are part owners in that power plant. And the Saw River Project makes the decisions. They go to their partners, and they all decide on what's going to be done.
Okay.
But for the CAP, it made sense for us to pump the water during the winter when the need is less.
Okay.
And store the water behind Lake Pleasant. And then when the need is the highest, we would deliver by gravity, make releases out of Lake Pleasant to the users who need it downstream.
Okay. And then 1966-67, I want to go back to Grand Canyon for a minute. You had mentioned a professor that had, in a geology class, I think that was Milford Benham, who and you'd hiked to Phantom and Havasu with him. In 66, 67, did you do any more hiking in Grand Canyon?
Yes. Well, I don't know if that particular year I did, but I did. During those particular years, I didn't, but I made new friends at the Bureau of Reclamation.
Okay.
And my friends were outdoor people.
Okay.
As well as non-outdoor, but I made a lot of friends. But I also, where I met Claude Johnson, C.L. Johnson, and I think if you look at the records, he was one of the supreme hikers of the Grand Canyon. He did, he was the equivalent to Harvey.
Okay.
But at the time, he was just a hunter when I met him.
Okay.
He worked in engineering, and we became friends and did a lot of hunting trips together. And over the years, both of us would convert into Grand Canyon hiking. And another good friend of mine who was not a hunter, a black engineer from the South, Willie Samuel, who would later join the group of the Grand Canyon hikers.
Can you spell these gentlemen's names for me, please?
Sure. Claude Johnson, known as CL.
Okay.
Johnson, J-O-H-N, S-O-N, Johnson. And Willie Samuels, W-I-L-L-Y, I believe. Samuels, S-A-M-M-U-E-L.
And Claude is C-L-A-U-D-E?
C-L-A-U-D-E, yes.
Thank you.
But nobody ever called him Claude. It was always C-L.
C-L. And was Willie Samuels called Willie?
It's what now?
Did Willie have a nickname?
Just Willie.
And did you have a nickname?
No, my parents used to call me Pancho.
Okay.
Did
C.L. and Willie call you Pancho?
Yeah, occasionally they would. But,
okay.
It stuck with me off and on, but
okay.
These were Willie and C.L. both were not Hispanic, and Pancho is something more in the Hispanic community they would call me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. As a term of endearment.
But that's correct, but C.L. and Willie would also every once in a while call me Pancho. And,
okay.
But these are two people from the people that I met at the Bureau of Reclamation that would later become regulars on our hikings of the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
But at the time, Willie worked with me in hydrology. C.L. was an engineer on the design section, and he was C.L. was assigned to surveys, and he did outdoor surveys for the canal.
Okay.
But C.L. and I did a lot of hunting together. We were, another person who did nothing in the canyon but was a hunter to the Bureau joined us many times, John Harrison. But C.L. has passed on. He died this year, I believe.
And, I'm sorry.
Willie's still alive, and so is Harrison.
Cool.
And we were with CL. I did a lot of hunting. And then during my time with the Bureau, again, I worked for the Bureau almost 10 years, almost, not quite.
Okay.
We did a bunch of us at the Bureau. Got together and decided to do a trip to Havasu.
What year was that?
I don't remember. It would have to be. I left the Bureau in 75, so it'd probably be around 73, somewhere in there.
Okay.
And we a bunch of us from the Bureau of Reclamation. All met there at the the parking area, and we went and spent several days down in Lake the Havasu Falls area.
Do you remember what time of year that was? Was it spring, fall, summer, winter?
Well, no, I don't.
Okay.
I don't remember the time, but it would have been. There was enough of the. We were all engineers and surveyors, and it was a large group. It was maybe planners. I'd say there was 25 or more of us that went down.
Okay.
And we enjoyed ourselves. It was a large group of Bureau of Reclamation employees and. We all had a great time, enjoyed ourselves, and camped. I'll also mention, interesting, I think it was during that time that we saw the butterflies, when they hatch, before they become butterflies, they are the
caterpillars?
Worms.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, the caterpillars, and there was a huge birth of them occurring down in Havasu.
Huh.
And I took a picture, which I have, of one of our tents covered in these little worms.
Oh, that, wow. Huh.
They were all over the ground. You couldn't walk where you'd step on a butterfly.
Oh, my gosh.
The entire area, and By luck, we happened to be down there during that time period.
Hmm. Okay. So that makes me think it might have been in the spring sometime?
Probably, yeah.
Okay.
But since then, and this is what makes it confusing for me, is I've been to Havasu many times, and I don't really remember. I'm saying I think it happened during that period, but I'm not sure.
So they're all blending. They're blending together, those trips.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But it was a fantastic time because everywhere you look, there were these caterpillars, and unfortunately, if you walked, you killed a bunch of them. And there were several people camping there at Havasu, and that's where they were. They were by the thousands. They were everywhere.
So in 73, there would have been a ranger station there. Do you remember interfacing with the ranger there at all?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I just remember that particular incident.
Okay.
And I have no interface with the ranger. In don't think every trip we took, we didn't interface with the ranger. As time went on, we became, we always enjoyed the trips to Havasu, and we would check the mining that was going on and all around us. And as we actually even many times would climb up above Havasu and the level above it and climb up in there when we were down there.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And so we enjoyed that trip. It was just engineers mostly.
Nice.
And planners, and we had a large group, and everybody made it out okay. So it was tough for some. Many were not in condition, but it was a memorable trip.
And, nice.
I have a picture of all of us together that took that trip, but it would have been like 1973.
Okay. Did you use the ponies to get your backpacks down to the village and then back up again, or were you just everybody carrying everything?
I don't remember.
Okay.
And I know one year we actually rented a lodge, and that might have been the year that we actually rented a lodge. I don't remember if the lodges were even there in 73.
Okay.
They may not have been, so maybe we would have rented, because this was not... We were not super hikers at that time. We were outdoorsmen and all wanted to see that. So I'm not sure. In all probability, we would have rented mules.
Okay.
Because these were people that wanted to see Havasu but weren't necessarily in the best of condition.
Okay. All right. Can you tell me a little bit more about Claude and Willie?
Absolutely. Theo was born in Arizona in a mining town. His father worked in the mines. And he was an athlete.
Okay.
He went to North High here in Phoenix, and he got a scholarship in football and baseball, I believe, to go to U of A and got his engineering degree out of U of A.
Oh, okay.
And he would, again, he was a super athlete and would later probably, and I don't think I'm exaggerating this, he died, he was 10 years older than I was, so I'm 81, so if he was alive today, he'd be 91.
Okay.
But CL would do ultra marathons.
Oh.
Hike runs through the mountains. There was one particular race he would always take part in Prescott, where man against horse.
Oh, my.
And man would actually beat the horses, but, of course, they would start flat, and then they would go up into the mountains. And these people were in better shape than the animals were in climbing the mountains. And CL did 15-mile marathons. I'm sure he did, up in the mountains, the Mogollon Rim. And he became, before he died, he had to be one of the oldest marathon runners alive. He was unbelievable. And then later, when he became a Grand Canyon addiction, and I, at some point later on, we'll talk about, we used to take part in races from the North Rim to the Grand, to the South Rim.
Okay.
And they were not authorized races, but we would actually do, rent a bus, and people from all over the United States would take part in these races. And,
okay.
We would start from the North Rim and run down, go up the Bright Angel, and see who could get there first. And we had trophies for them. And this continued until the Park Service said, you don't have permission to do this. You will stop. Or if we see you here next year, we're going to fine you. So we stopped.
Okay. All right. Well, I definitely want to hear more about that when we get more close to it.
Right. Right. And then Willie Samuel was brought up in a segregated South. He was actually older than I am, not much, but
okay.
a little bit. And he was from Texas, Texarkana, Texas, where the middle of the street, one side was Texas and the other side was Arkansas.
Okay.
And Willie got an engineering degree. He served in the Army, became an engineer, and came to work for the Bureau of Reclamation. He was raised in the South during the ultimate segregation, and but Willie was a very congenial, nice-going individual that loved the outdoors, and his bigger thing was bicycling. He would do a major bicycling all across, took part in events in the eventually, he would move to Colorado, where he lives today, and would take huge bicycling events. And but he would always join us when we did a Grand Canyon hike, if he could make it.
Okay. So he would come from Colorado to join you guys?
That's correct.
Nice. Nice.
And but then the other big event, working for the Bureau, it was probably in the, it was soon after I graduated. I was working in the Phoenix office, and Congress was cutting money for the planning office because nobody was sure when the CAP was going to be built, and so they decided to say, we're going to cut money to the Phoenix Planning Office. Well, the Bureau knew that that didn't mean we didn't want to lose our engineers, we didn't want to lose our people.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did, we had a project in St. George, Utah, and that was, they were looking at building a dam off of the Virgin River, which did get built, by the way.
Okay.
And but the Bureau of Reclamation was looking at building a dam off of the Virgin River and storing Virgin River water for the use in St. George, Utah.
Okay.
And they didn't have enough planning people to do it, so they moved the Phoenix Development Office, which was planning on the CAP, and transferred us on per diem to St. George, Utah, to do the planning on the Virgin River project.
Okay.
And we did much of what we were doing in Phoenix, except we were now doing it in St. George, Utah.
Okay.
And it was during the summer, and we were assigned, I think it was like 4 months assignment there at St. George, and we stayed in motels. And we went to work every day at the Bureau of Reclamation office and did planning there for the project. And we put together a plan for the Virgin River project. And it was Let's see. And during that period, I went crazy, of course, in the Arizona Strip.
Okay.
I spent many hours there exploring the Arizona Strip area. And the history, again, a big part of me is very much into history. And this was in the early, this was in the 60s. So
68, 69-ish?
Somewhere in there, yeah.
Okay.
And there was a, at the time, St. George was a very Mormon community. In fact, several of our black engineers worried about going by themselves to eat in the evening. They thought they were back in the South. And, of course, I loved history, and I went and visited the Mount Meadows Massacre site,
okay,
where the Mormons killed 130 people, men, women, and children. And it was a, you had to be careful who you spoke to there, because it was, today that's not true, by the way. St. George is a very ultra a city, as you would find anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, we're talking a very Mormon community.
Okay.
And even outside of St. George, there were the polygamous people were living in the area around Mesquite and that area.
Okay.
But it was an opportunity for me to explore much of the Strip country.
Did you get
and
out
also
to did you get out to Torah Week? Did you have a chance to meet John Riffey? Was he there at the time?
I did go to Torah Week during that time period. Yes, I went to Torah Week many times. In fact, when we get into my hikes, we did Lava Falls Trail also.
Okay. All right.
And we did. I went to Torah Week, I believe, during that period. Every weekend I was gone.
Were you still in the Ford station wagon, or did you get something a little more adaptable to that country?
No, I was still in my Ford station wagon.
My, because I'm thinking there's a lot of roads out there you can get out to Kanab Point and Whitmore Wash and just a number of wonderful places out there, but it would be a little challenging in a Ford station wagon, but not impossible.
But I think at some point, and I don't know when, I did sell my Ford station wagon and got a Ford pickup truck.
Okay, four-wheel drive or two-wheel drive?
Two-wheel drive.
Okay.
But it was a pickup truck, and it had a high clearance.
Okay.
And I avoided the four-wheel drive until later on in my life. But,
okay.
At that time, I believe, I'm not sure, I'm trying to remember, but I think I had a Ford pickup truck at the time.
Okay, all right. What do you remember about places? Did you meet anyone out there? I mean, Al Craig might have been out there. I'm trying to think about who else would have been ranching out there. The Bundys would have been down near Mount Trumbull. I'm just thinking.
I went down to Mount Trumbull, but I did not meet any of the people out there.
Okay.
But I did take pictures today of places that no longer exist.
Okay.
One picture I took of a crossing with a little handmade bridge that's gone, and I also, not much Rancho Yeto disappeared today. I took many, it was at its peak then, and I would, every weekend I was gone somewhere.
Okay, hang on a second, wait a minute, Rancho what?
There was a little tiny building up on the strip.
Okay.
That some Mormon had put across the top of it, written in it, and there was a sofa, a couch, not a couch, but a single person chair.
Okay.
Out in front, and on the top of it, it said, "Not much Rancho Yeto." And it was in very well painted sign, and it was, if you went into the strip country, the first thing you saw was that building. It was right on the next to the road.
Huh.
It was a single unit structure.
Okay.
And it was, but I took pictures of it. In fact, I've got an entire series of pictures from when it was at its best back then to when it started disintegrating until it finally fell apart and it no longer exists.
Was this on the road that starts kind of southwest out of St. George and goes sort of due south down past Wolf Hole and off to Mount Trumbull?
That's correct.
Okay.
Well, you can get to Mount Trumbull a couple of ways. You can come out of Kanab and you can go straight through St. George.
Right.
This was Montmuch Rancho Yeddo went right through St. George, not through Kanab.
Right.
And it was when you got up on the top of the strip country, you know, St. George is down on the Virgin River, and you would climb, that road would get you up on top where the strip began, and that not much Rancho Yeddo was up on the top.
Okay, got it.
And then I would explore all of the strip country, but I not until later would I actually make my way, because any trail that you took there to the north rim of the Grand Canyon was pretty rough.
Okay.
You needed four-wheel drive to get there, and I had a two-wheel drive vehicle, but I explored all of the Arizona Strip that I could do.
Okay.
And some of the roads were passable, were two-wheel drive. But as you got closer to the north rim, it became four-wheel drive.
Right. But you would have had access to Mount Trumbull. Did you climb up Mount Trumbull?
Oh, many times.
Nice.
I didn't climb it. I drove it.
Okay.
There's a ranger station on top of it, I came to Mount Trumbull. We used to hunt Mount Trumbull all the time.
Okay.
And I drove up through, went through Bundyville, and up on top of Trumbull, and I hunted south of Trumbull towards the area that would go right into the canyon.
Okay.
And I did a lot. I killed a deer on one of those sections that drive down into directly into the canyon. And so I spent a lot of time in all of that. And, of course, Toro Weep, Mount Trumbull, Bundyville, and
did you get down to Whitmore, down to the Bartan Ranch down there?
I don't know if that's the name of it, but there's a big ranch on that main road from St. George, and there's a big sign there telling this is the location where the Powell brothers were killed.
Oh, okay, that's further north, right?
Yeah, there's a big ranch there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then I would go past that to where the BLM had a facility out there, nobody, you could spend days out there and never see another human being.
Yeah.
But the BLM built a little ranch out there, and they had a place where the planes could fly in if they needed to.
Did you get out to Kelly Point or out to that further to the west?
No, this was right where Dellenbaugh is.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. Yep.
Right at the base of Dellenbaugh, there was a BLM branch there.
Yes.
And I climbed Dellenbaugh many times, but
nice.
I've got pictures of the carvings of Dunn.
Okay.
On the rock on top of Dellenbaugh.
Okay.
And that's pretty rare because I tried for a while even to get the Park Service or somebody to remove that rock and put it in somewhere where it would be safe.
Mm.
Nobody seemed to care. And it's very difficult to find it. It's almost impossible to find it. But it's up there among thousands, millions of black volcanic rocks. And
right.
Every year it becomes less and less. Eventually it'll disappear, but nobody seems to want to protect it. So.
Yeah, yeah. Huh. So a lot of time when you were in the 4 months you were there at St. George, you were on the strip, sounds like, most every weekend.
Just about. I did not spend my weekends in St. George. I would spend them exploring the country.
Okay.
Whether it was in Utah or southern Arizona, down towards Mesquite. And I explored a lot of that country during that time period. Also, I discovered, which was interesting, I got a lot of pictures of it. I also discovered some of the historical ranches that were abandoned. Everything in the strip seemed to be abandoned today. Mm-hmm. As you went in there, at least at that time, it were, except for the big ranch on that I ran into that was there at, I forget what it was called, where the sign says, this is where the Powell brothers were killed.
Okay.
We also, I explored a lot of that country as long as I could get in there. If it was, there was also a mining, a lumber camp that was burned. It was right off of Dellenbaugh, on the west side of Dellenbaugh. They had a logging camp there, and it burned. And the trucks are still there, burned, the remains of the trucks. And even the logs were piled up ready to be taken out.
Oh, wow.
And it's in the middle of nowhere. It's in a location where nobody sees it, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it's on the far side of Dellenbaugh,
near
that big canyon that's there. There's a big canyon that is on the west side of Dellenbaugh. I can't think of the name right now. But
kind of separation maybe in there?
No, I don't think separation comes up that high. I forget what they call it, but it's on the west side of Dellenbaugh, sort of the northwest side of Dellenbaugh, and it's a big canyon that comes through there.
I need to get a map.
And if you look at a map, it's a huge. You can't miss it. It's the biggest canyon in there.
Like Surprise, right, or on the, one of those.
I can't remember the name of it, but I also have pictures of Dellenbaugh. Not Dellenbaugh, but Separation Canyon. In later years, I went in there and hiked some remote areas. Once I did get a four-wheel drive, I went all the way to the edge of the strip country to where the canyon is, and I actually hiked to the upper end of Separation Canyon and took pictures of where Separation starts as it draws down into the Colorado.
Okay, cool.
And I did a lot of that, but that occurred in later years when I did have a four-wheel drive.
So the 68-69 was sort of your introduction to the Arizona Strip and the northwestern part of the Grand Canyon.
That's correct, which I would continue to hunt.
Okay.
I hunted the strip country, and I hunted even after I went back to Phoenix, because they then got money to fund us, and they sent us back to Phoenix. And I worked there until 1975. And also during my period with the Phoenix office, I would be on assignments to Denver. The Bureau of Reclamation Main Planning Office is in Denver, Colorado. I would have a lot of summer assignments and winter assignments to Denver, Colorado, and I spent months, and I even hunted up in Colorado when I was up there with some of the engineers that were in the Bureau office in Denver. And
Is that why CL ended up in Colorado?
No, his kids moved to Colorado.
Oh, okay.
And his wife wanted to be with her kids. So
that makes sense. Sure.
They moved there.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. Okay. And what kind of assignments did you get in Denver at the offices there?
Well, mainly we were looking at, we had many dams proposed for the Arizona area.
Okay.
What we would do, we prepare these flood make-believe floods, if you will, but we would design the dams to protect against these floods. Hydrology would design the dams and then give them to the design people, and then the design people would take these floods and protect a proposed dam against this by building a spillway that was big enough to take that flood.
Okay.
And if it was a dam that... the dams were built, one, to store water, two, for flood control, and third, with a spillway. And each one of the, like, flood control, you'd have what they call a standard project flood. Usually that didn't involve the Bureau. That would involve the Corps of Engineers, because anything to do with flood control included the Corps of Engineers.
Okay.
But, and then there was the design, because the Bureau would design the dam, you'd have to design this huge flood that would hit the dam. And what I did in hydrology with the Bureau was we would design these dams, these floods for Orme Dam, for all the Hooker Dam, for all the dams that were being proposed in Arizona and New Mexico. By the way, none of them got built, but we would design, and then the design people would design the dams with a spillway that could take the dam and pass it, the flood, and pass it through.
Right. Okay.
And during that time, they called me one day and said, "Would you like to go to Malaysia and do a study on a dam in Malaysia?"
Oh, wow!
I said, "You betcha, Red Rider." And so they sent me to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, for 3 months.
What year was that?
That would be 1974-75.
Okay.
And I was, and the Bureau had made a deal. The federal government was giving money to Malaysia for water. And, of course, there were stipulations that said, if you want our money, you got to hire the Bureau of Reclamation, and they'll do the planning for you. So
okay.
It was federal money coming through the government of Malaysia.
Okay.
And I was there for about 4 months.
Wow.
And doing engineering design for Klang Gates Dam and two other dams that I can't remember in Malaysia. And it was, so I spent 4 months doing these designs, flood designs for dams that were in Malaysia. And it was a great, great experience. I lived in Kuala Lumpur and learned a lot about their culture, their history, then when I came back,
Hang on, wait.
Yeah.
Let's not leave Malaysia yet. What were, as you're thinking back on it now, which is almost 50 years, not quite. What were a couple of the really cool things that happened to you or that you saw there?
Well, one is I almost got killed. Blown up by a bomb.
Oops.
They had their terrorists. This was, I believe, Vietnam. I don't know if Vietnam was still going, but Malaysia had terrorists that were trying to take over the government. They had a history of the British owned Malaysia at one time, and then the British decided to give it back to the people. But by this time, you had three major races that were in Malaysia. The Indian race, because the Indians had moved in there, Chinese had moved in there, and the Malay people.
Okay.
Chinese were the major other race that was in Malaysia. And the British didn't want a war when they left, so they gave Singapore to the Chinese.
Okay.
And they gave Malaysia, the mainland of Malaysia, to the Malay people, kings, and to Malay people. And the Indians weren't large enough number to deal with, but they wanted, because the Chinese and the Malays were on the verge of civil war when the British pulled out. So there was, and then I guess some of these Chinese were communist Chinese that were in the jungles still fighting to try to take over Malaysia. And so there was a lot of tension. And you had Vietnam, which I don't remember was over yet, but it wasn't very far from Malaysia. So one day we used to go to different things. They had a statue dedicated to the Malaysian people that had fought the Japanese during World War II, and he said, would you like to see it? And I said, I sure would. And so me and one of the other engineers after work, they took us to this huge statue, bronze statue-like, but you actually walked inside of it.
Huh.
And inside they had plaques and memorabilia to the heroes of the Malaysian people who fought the Japanese during World War II. Well, it was after work, so it was in the evening. I went through, and then afterwards I went to my, they took me back to my hotel where I was staying. And the next morning I grabbed the newspaper, and that night the insurgents had blown the statue up.
Wow.
And probably the dynamite was in there when I was walking around down there.
Hmm.
But they blew it up in the middle of the night, and I was not there at the middle of the night. But I consider that a near death. So, but they you basically there was a lot of tensions between the Chinese and the Malays, but they were doing the same thing we were doing in the United States. They were trying to elevate Malaysians to high positions, which were all held by the Chinese. Chinese were very forward, very wanted to advance, while the Malay were very manana people. About they didn't rush at anything. They were easygoing, laid down people. Well, the Chinese, of course, somebody once told me, if you want to know how the Chinese are looked at in Asia, same way the Europeans look at the Jews. That's the way the Asians would look at the Chinese. Because as you know, the Chinese come in and they want to advance. They do everything to prosper and benefit. And they were the top people in Malaysia. And a little bit of history, in Mexico, the same thing happened. And Mexican government threw them all out of China in the 1920s. And these were people who no longer spoke Chinese, only spoke Spanish.
Wow.
And they outlawed them because the Chinese were, this was right after the Mexican Revolution, but the Chinese owned, had all prospered and were all the money. And, of course, the Mexicans were very poor.
Hmm.
Same thing was happening in Malaysia with the Chinese and the Malays.
Well, Frank, what was the name of the dam you were working on?
Klang Gates was the main one.
How do you spell that?
K-L-A-N-G-G-A-T-E-S, Klang Gates.
Okay.
And then there were two other dams that I don't remember their names.
All right.
They weren't built yet. Klang Gates, I think, was built, and we were looking at safety for the dam, make sure the spillways were adequate to take care of the big floods.
Okay.
And then there were two other dams they were proposing to build, and we were looking at those also, but I can't remember their names. But
right.
Klang Gates, I remember, and that was an existing dam that we were looking to. They wanted to know if the spillways were adequate to handle the big flood.
And anything else that happened on that Malaysian trip that you remember now?
Well, one of them is I went to a small community in Malaysia where St. Francis was buried.
Oh, my.
And it was interesting. I'm Catholic, and they took us to a what was remains of a church, and there's a big hole in the ground. And St. Francis, either Xavier or Assisi, I think it was Assisi, died in Malaysia and was buried there.
Wow.
And then later the people from his hometown in Italy came and dug him up and took him back to Italy.
Okay.
But when he died, he died in Malaysia and was buried inside this church,
wow,
which no longer exists. It was disintegrating, and they had a big wire deal over the top of the hole where he was buried. That was major. And,
yeah. Gosh, I would think as a Catholic, that would be very moving to see that.
And the other thing is, there were other engineers there working from Australia and New Zealand.
Hmm.
And I met many engineers from Australia and New Zealand, which is for a local boy from Phoenix, Arizona was interesting. And
I bet.
So it was a major experience for me that and then when I was done.
Was that your hey Frank? I'm going to jump in just one more here.
Yeah.
Was that your first time out of the United States?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Thank you.
Except for Mexico, not true. I had visited Canada and I had visited Mexico.
Okay.
And but other than that, this was the first time out of the Western Hemisphere.
First time overseas. Yeah.
That's correct.
Okay.
And when I came back, Malaysia is very close to halfway around the world. And so the government had to take me back to Phoenix, Arizona. Well, I took annual leave and paid the difference, which I had to pay some more money to go the other way around the world.
Oh, wow.
And I went, I was able to I took a month's vacation, and I made up the difference between the Bureau paying me to go back to Phoenix by way of Washington, D.C. in that area, or to come back around the world and stop at different locations and make a vacation for me and come back through California to Phoenix.
Okay.
Well, And the difference was like $300.
Oh, wow.
So I paid the difference, and my trip started. I went to Singapore, and then I wanted to see Israel.
Okay.
And there's a whole story there, because to get from where I was in Singapore to Israel, I had to go through Iran.
Okay.
And at the time, Iran was the Shah had just stepped down, and there was a lot of turmoil going on. But I had to go. The planes were still flying from Iran to Israel.
Okay.
And so I went through quite an experience there.
You know what? Hey Frank.
Yeah.
I would like to hear more about this. We've been talking for about an hour. And
right.
This might be a good place to put a comma here, and then we can come back to your journey from Kuala Lumpur, continuing on your global your circumnavigation of the globe. Does that sound like a good plan?
That sounds excellent. That's good.
Okay. Well, then with that, this will conclude part three of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Frank Barrios. Today is Monday, January 30th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Frank, thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.